But for the subjects which people want to talk about on a Friday night, I often invite people to send in suggestions, and tonight is following one suggestion. Somebody was reading some of the sutras of the Buddha. These are the early teachings of Buddhism, and they're getting a bit of confused on the place of like love and lust and desire and affection in Buddhism. And what actually is the place of love in the Dharma in Buddhism? Is love an attachment? Is love something beautiful? Is love going to get you into trouble? What is the place of love in Buddhism? And it's relevant because, as many of you know, I wasn't here last week. Sister Hasapani was here. You see, our nuns there starting to give talks, which is wonderful to see the development of our communities here. And I was away in a conference in Sri Lanka, and then a talk in Singapore, and then another sort of conference in Malaysia, in Malacca. But it was the 90th anniversary of a temple in Malacca, and they wanted to do something instead of just doing rituals and ceremonies to have like a group of international speakers. So as it was, I was free, so I accepted the invitation to go there. But one of the unexpected events which happened there was a lady who was, she'd heard me talk before, and she was getting married. And about 3 months ago, she thought, wouldn't it be wonderful if I could get Ajahn Brahm to do my marriage blessing? But how can I get him to come all the way to Malacca? It's impossible. And even though that was her hope, she just went past the temple and she saw this big sign saying Ajahn Brahm is coming to Malacca on the very day that she'd arranged her marriage. So she was so delighted that she could actually get me for a marriage ceremony. And of course, you know, I bless anything. So very happy to bless her marriage for her. And she's a model. She's got her own TV show in Malaysia. So she's quite a well-known personality there. And why is it that they want a spiritual person as being part of their marriage? What is important there? And of course, being as like as a monk, you always actually question, you investigate everything you do in life. Why is it that at that time when a person commits to another person, why is it they always want a spiritual part of the life? What is actually spiritual about that love? And this is what I'm going to talk about, and how you can make use of the understanding of, you know, the love which you feel at a marriage, which sometimes you lose later on in your relationship, how you can actually take that and use that and bring it to a higher level and understand the place of love in the spiritual life, and how you can take it to levels which you maybe not realize are actually possible, and to get sort of a beautiful and powerful and blissful type of love which has got no one, no ownership, no person involved. But let's start at the very beginning, because one of the reasons why people think that Buddhism is against love is because at the very, very beginning, you know, we have love starts with lust when you're very young, and sometimes it's very easy to confuse the love with the lust. And it's not as if that Buddhist monks are like a Puritans and say lust is no good. Then, you know, you must all be celibate like, you know, we guys up on this platform up here. Now, monks are not Puritans. Buddhism is not puritanical. And it's very sort of celebratory of all the different aspects of life. I remember reading a definition of Puritanism just before I went overseas. And that is, the definition of Puritanism is that the fear that somewhere someone is happy. You know, some religions are like that. You know, as if, like, if you're happy, you must be making a sin or something, or you must be doing something wrong. And certainly I think you've seen this, the way that the Buddhist monks and nuns have taught here. There's nothing like that at all. You know, we're fun-loving monks and fun-loving nuns. But when the Buddha was talking about that first type of lust, he said, well, look, you know, there's pleasure there, there's also danger there. And it's also, he called that the escape. There's three little things which you look at with each of these different aspects of your life. You know, the pleasure in sort of in the lust, but also the danger. And also knowing that there's like an escape, how to avoid those dangers. And of course, you all know sort of the pleasures of lust, but the dangers also. And that's, you know, where you have sex or have a relationship outside of your commitment. So, you know, you have a partner in life, or maybe a temporary partner, but if you start playing around outside of that committed relationship, that causes a huge amount of pain and trouble for people. And even though that should be quite obvious, still sometimes just the lust becomes so powerful that we forget, you know, the fact that it's going to hurt us. At the moment it's great fun, but later on it's going to cause all sorts of problems for our family, for our kids, and for everybody else who's involved in that relationship. Now, that's all very well to know the danger, but unless you know how to escape from that danger, in other words, the strategy, so you don't put yourself in that position, or so if you do find some lust, you can actually do something about it. You know, one of the things which I said over in Malacca was the importance of honesty in a relationship. And I mean really important, to raise honesty to such a high level that you respect it above everything else, even infidelity. What I mean by that is if your partner comes up to you and says, "No, darling, I'm really sorry, but, you know, I've had lust to somebody else, or I've even actually kissed them, or I've even had a sexual liaison with them." If they come up and own up and are honest to you, respect their honesty so much that you won't scold them or punish them. You give them what you might call amnesty, because they've been honest. Because the very fact they've come up to tell you what they've done means that they trust you and they just really want to repair the hurt which they've done. They have the right intentions there. They were weak, they made a mistake. But their honesty is such, they want your help. That's why they told you. They want your help to try and make sure they never do that again, and they can put the relationship with the person they really love back on track. But what happens with most people? They're so afraid of being scolded. They're so afraid of what you will say to them. They're so afraid that, you know, that basically that it will hurt the whole relationship. They never tell the truth. They hide it. That's one of the reasons why relationships fail. Because we don't trust the other person to understand that we're frail, we are weak, we made a mistake, and we're afraid of being scolded. It takes a lot for you to do that, to respect honesty so much that you can allow the other person to say some really, really bad weaknesses and you don't scold them. Because if you're scolding them, if you tell them off, if you get really upset, are they going to tell you the whole story in future? Obviously not. The same with parents and your children. Please, if your children are honest to you, they come up to you and say they've taken drugs or done something else, please don't shout at them. Don't scold them. Say, "Thank you so much. You've been honest with your mum, with your dad. I forgive you straight away. Now, how can we work together so that we can solve this problem so it never occurs again?" If you don't have that sort of attitude, will your children tell you their problems? Or will they be scared to tell mummy and daddy about the mistakes in life, even their big mistakes? So honesty has to be so high in the values which we espouse, but it takes precedence over everything else, and we want to encourage it so people in a relationship don't hide things. And that gives you an idea of what love truly means. It means, okay, you've got some lust sometimes, but there's a love which is higher than lust. That type of love is something which is more selfless, uncontrolling, which can accept the other person. But I've run ahead of myself for a bit. That lust, we need to be able to know the escape from lusts so that if we don't put ourselves in a position to hurt the people we really love. And of course, each one of you from time to time, you probably have done things wrong which you haven't told your partners about. It's not just man's problem, women's problems. We have equity in this Buddhist society, fairness for all. And so when those things happen, remember there's a danger there. And of course the escape is very easy. To see the priorities in life, what's really important to you. Do you really just want to have that fun in the moment and sacrifice the long-term happiness of a committed relationship? Do you want the same thing to happen to you? So first of all, see the danger. And it's just so easy to stop that. And one of the things is tell your partner straight away that, you know, that you're finding some lust with this person. That you find an attraction there. Tell them, and the other person, your partner, should respect your honesty. Okay, I'm glad you're telling me that. Now we can actually, I know what you're doing. I know what the other partner is doing. I can actually help you make sure that doesn't go any further. Whatever it is, find a way out of those dangers in a relationship. But I should really go to the more interesting forms of love. And that is the sort of thing when it's not just lust. There you've been going out together for a long time. You come to this moment where you really want to commit to each other. And usually in public, which is why we have these marriage ceremonies. And it's actually true that when you actually commit together in public, that means the relationship you have does go to another level. It means you are really sort of saying that, yeah, I am serious about this relationship. I'm committing. It's really important. The joke which I usually say about commitment, for those of you who forgot the book which I wrote a long time ago, or who haven't been to one of my marriage ceremonies recently, is the difference between involvement and commitment is the same as the difference between bacon and eggs. Think about it. Involvement, commitment, bacon and eggs. Because in bacon and eggs, the pig is committed, the chicken is only involved. Do you get it? You know, when the first time I told that joke was on a radio show in Singapore. And the fellow who was doing the show got it straight away, and he actually fell on the floor laughing. And you know, I know enough about radio that you have to keep speaking. If you're not speaking for more than, I forget what the rule is, 15 seconds, the radio show gets fined. So he was actually pointing to me, the microphone, say something, because he was paralytic for about 30, 40 seconds. Because it's true, the chicken only gives an egg, but the pig gives its whole life. You know, actually, that story, my book, Open the Door of Your Heart, has been translated into many languages, and it's being translated into Hebrew, but that story had to be taken out. Pigs. It's really crazy, isn't it? Anyway, that type of commitment puts it on a different level. And what that's actually really saying, that commitment, because it's long term, it's also getting very close to what we call unconditional love. I'm not putting a time limit on this. I'm saying to this partner that I know that you're not going to be perfect, but nevertheless, I'm committing to you. And that's actually one of the reasons why I always find that type of love, when it's expressed, especially at that marriage ceremony, is something which is spiritual, far different than lust. This is actually a selfless opening the door of your heart to another person and saying that, look, I am going to love you unconditionally, no matter who you are. But a lot of the time, at these ceremonies, especially modern marriage ceremonies, that people make their vows to one another. And you make up your own vows these days. And it's very interesting to listen to the vows these two people make together. This wedding I did in Malacca, they wrote to me about who should say the vow first, the boy or the girl. It's an interesting question, isn't it? My answer was, well, it was the boy who proposed, it was his idea, so he should make the vow first. And that gives the girl a chance to change her vow once she's heard his. It gives them an advantage. But what the vows are usually these days is people actually saying what they really respect in the other person. What they're actually doing is actually they're looking at another person and deliberately seeing their beautiful qualities, praising them, bring them out. This is what I like about you. This is why I'm choosing you. And I notice that in the life which we live, too often that we look at other people with the opposite type of mind. Not a mind which looks at their beautiful qualities, but a mind which always finds fault with people. We are a very critical society. And that's why it's so rare to see someone who in public tells us what a beautiful person we are. It's really strange and weird. The other time, when people publicly say what a beautiful person you are, apart from your wedding, is your funeral service. During the rest of the time, they tell you what a rotten person you are, all your mistakes, the stupid things you do, the bad jokes you tell, the fact you pick your nose, all these other things which you do. They always find fault with you. But at a marriage and a funeral, they all say nice things about you. Why can't we say the nice things in between as well? But at least that gives it a sense of the spiritual there, because we're not having a fault-finding mind, we're having a mind which will appreciate and find gratitude and find beauty in things. And that is such an important part of a spiritual life. In your world, you're like managers, so you have to find fault to fix up those faults, to mend it. You have an electrician who fixes up the faults, a plumber who fixes the leaks, a manager who makes sure, you know, the things in the contract which aren't working get fixed up. We spend so much time fixing up the faults in this world, you know, cleaning the dishes, fixing the gutters, tidying up the rooms. We're such fault finders and fixers that sometimes that's what we do when we have a relationship. You fix up your partner. You find the faults and try and plug them. And of course, that is the problem with relationships. At a marriage, that's not there. At a funeral, that's not there. Which is one of the reasons why it's a much purer type of love. And it's also a time for selflessness, which is one of the most important parts of love. I already mentioned that love is like seeing the good in somebody. And also, the other one is actually the bit of selflessness. Many of you have heard me say this before, but it's an important part of a relationship. But not just a relationship with your partner, a relationship with yourself, a relationship with your body, a relationship with life as well. And that's why at those marriages which I do very often, the same which I did last week in Malaysia, I look at both people and say, from now on you should not think of yourself. And they always say, yeah. I'm married now, I'm not thinking, and look at each other. And then when they're looking at each other, I say, you shouldn't think of your partner either. And that's when it gets interesting. Because that gets them confused. Because there's another way, and that's a problem in relationships. When you think of yourself, you're selfish. When you think of the other, you sacrifice. You burn out. There's nothing left in the relationship for you after a while. It's all about the other person. And many of you may have been in relationships like that. That's not love. So instead you say, from now on you should never think of yourself, you should never think of your partner, you should only think of us. You know, that's a totally different perception in a relationship. It's not about me, it's not about her or him, it's about us. And that's such a beautiful attitude, not just for a relationship, but for life as well. I just mentioned earlier when you were doing your meditation, to make sure that, you know, that your mindfulness, your kindness and your breath all walk together hand in hand. It's about us. It's about the relationship we have with these things. And if it is you are in control of something, if you think that you are the mistress and your breath is your slave, you'll never ever get anywhere in your meditation. In the same way, if you think that you are the master and my wife is my chattel, under my control, then things go terribly, terribly wrong. And I don't know how many times I remember in my youth, you used to have all these love songs. One day, baby, you will be mine. And even then I realized there's something really wrong there. Number one, she's not a baby anymore. 25 years old, for goodness sake. But number two, what do you mean being mine? Because too often the relationships when you own somebody, what type of sharing is that? Because that is a red light in Buddhism, ownership. The whole purpose of the spiritual path is to realize, not actually to let go because you're trying to be a goody-goody, but to when you realize you don't own anything anyway, that's what happens. You let go of things because this body isn't mine, this partner isn't mine, my clothes aren't mine, nothing is yours. What is yours? What do you think you own anyway? So when you own things, you tend to control them. Just if you think you own your breath, you'll control your breath, you'll never get peaceful in meditation. So if you think you own your children, you will control them. And you kids who've had a parent or mother, father, who think they own you, and they're always controlling you, and it's my son, my daughter, that's a big problem. It's not your son, not your daughter. These are people who come into your life with history. You know, they're old beings when they come out of your tummy. And you know that they're only there for you for a certain length of time. Your job is to nurture them and let them go. Sure, they'll come back and you'll enjoy their company, but they're not yours. They're a great friend. But when you think they're my kid, that's when you own them, control them, you'll never really let them go. And for those of you who've had a parent like that, you know how uncomfortable it is, how the love is not pure. My parents were pretty good. I remember my poor old mother, when I was only a 17-year-old, I had my guitar, I had a sleeping bag, and I went off hitchhiking to Morocco. Must have drove her out of her mind, but she let me go. She knew I had to go. Imagine a mother worrying about a 17-year-old kid going to North Africa in 1968 or 7, whatever it was. I had a great time. I survived it. But she had that strength to always let me go, let me do things. Even becoming a monk. Remember I asked her, she said, do you mind me becoming a monk? And she said, no, I don't mind you becoming a monk, but what I don't like is you becoming a monk on the other side of the world. Kind of become a monk next door. Because your mother's like to see your kids. But she let me go. And that, I understood, was a beautiful way of giving love. To let the other person be, not to control them. And so in a relationship, especially in a marriage, is that type of love, which is saying, I'm going to love you, but you're not going to be mine. It's all about us. And I'm going to just love you for who you are, without controlling you, putting you in a cage. It's what we call that unconditional love. Unfortunately, that is what people say when they marry, but usually the next day it gets very different. At least the next year, when it becomes a lot of fear in that relationship, and fear is a precursor of control, as you all know. So once you become afraid of what might happen in the future, then you tend to get scared, and then you just get worried, and worry gets controlled, and you start making demands, putting boundaries on each other, and you know what that's like. The whole idea of like fear is actually the opposite of a love. A love is very, very trusting. And it also has this beautiful wisdom, and this is an important part in your life. If you make this moment right now beautiful and wonderful, that's the best you can possibly do for your future. Worrying about your future, and worrying what might happen, while you're neglecting the place your future is being made, causes many of the problems in life. So instead of worrying about the future and getting fear coming up in your mind, make this moment, this day, a beautiful day. Make this a pure day. And then you know you've done your very best to create a beautiful future for yourselves. So never sacrifice this moment for something in the future. Because then you really are sacrificing the future. This moment is important. The time you have together is really important. If you get this moment right now, today, beautiful, correct, and pure, of course your future is going to be wonderful. Looking just in my life as a monk, I've renounced so much. You know, you just don't, I don't have security at all. I don't have superannuation. I don't have money put aside for my old age. I don't have a place to go. I've got a little cave in my monastery down at Serpent Harbour. It's not even my monastery. If I misbehave or people don't like me, the Buddhist society can actually kick me out. I could be homeless. If I don't give any good talks, 2 or 3 bad talks in a row, that's it, Ajahn Brahm, out. We're going to have a census next year, apparently. And the census next year, if the number of Buddhists hasn't improved in Western Australia, Ajahn Brahm, out. So I've got no security. So how as a monk can I have no security? And how can I have no fear of what's going to happen next year or the years afterwards? Because I notice all I can ever do is to make sure in this beautiful moment called now, I'm kind, compassionate, peaceful, giving, sharing with each one of you. And I know if I keep doing that, I will always have lots of beautiful friends, and I'll always be cared for because I care for others. That's my security plan, that's my superannuation. Not monetary, not materialist, but knowing sort of spirituality, know some truths, know some love, and trusting in that. That's how I live my life. Fearless, no security, no safety net. Just living in the moment, being kind, being peaceful, doing as much compassion as I possibly can. Now, can you do that in your relationship too? Give yourself totally to this moment, trusting in the fact that if you really do understand what love really is, and you can make that love in this moment by your partner, yourself, the us in this relationship, to saying that this is the most important right now, everything else is not important. Future is not important, so you let go of all that fear, then you won't be controlling. And when there's no control, there's no me, there's no mine, then you can understand the beauty of real Buddhist love. It's a love with no strings attached, with no conditions, to say to the other person, the door of my heart is open to you, no matter who you are, no matter what you do. And of course, you all know that that was the expression which my father told me many, many years ago. It's still a very, very powerful moment for me in my life. So powerful. You know, there's some things which you can remember from many, many years ago when you were young, and you remember the time, the place, the situation where it happened. And I know that. Even though that I haven't lived in London for I don't know how many years, 40 years now, I even remember the place. Churchfield Road, Acton, London. That's where my father parked the car just after picking me up from school. He parked the car and he turned around to me, it's just an old car, and said, "Son, just want to tell you that whatever you do in your life, wherever you go, the door of my house will always be open to you." That's the way he said it, the door of his house. It was a council flat. Council flat was government-sponsored housing, because we're always very poor. So later on I realized that's not what my father meant, not his house. That was nothing much to open the door for anyone to. It meant his heart. It was an expression of unconditional love from a father to a son. And that meant so much to me. Now that was spiritual. Not a love which demanded something in return, but a love which bound with freedom. Strange, isn't it? Bounding with freedom. That bound me to that man. But he freed me. I could do whatever I want, go wherever I want, and do whatever I want. Things which would impress him, things which may embarrass him. But he said, whatever you do, the love is always there for you. Can you do that to your partner? I know that sometimes people think that their love is special, but it really hasn't grown to that level which we're trying to encourage people to reach in the spiritual life, especially in Buddhism. And because that sometimes it hasn't reached that point, that's where one has fear, that's where the relationship just falls apart, that's where you don't really take, you know, what began at the marriage ceremony, something pure and beautiful, and allow it to grow to something totally different and totally pure and wonderful. And so some years ago, I worked out a test, an acid test, to see if your relationship had reached that level yet or not. And the acid test is this. You're here this evening. Suppose your partner is not here this evening, but they're at home. And suppose that when you get home, you find there's a note on your door. And the note says this, "Darling, while you were at the Buddhist Society listening to the talk, I've gone off to Broome with your best friend for a dirty weekend." How would you feel? Would you feel upset? Or would you feel, "Oh, how wonderful that is, that my partner is having such a wonderful time with my best friend. The door of my heart is so open to you." Is that how you would react? Or would you think, "That unfaithful dog, that's..." I can't say much more. I know I've got into trouble before using expletives. How would you react? Why is it you react with anger, with a sense of being humiliated? Why do you do that? It's interesting. It's because it's not the real love. It's the love which tends to own that person, demanding something back in return for what you give them. It's not the pure spiritual love. That pure spiritual love, if it was that, "The door of my heart is so open to you. Whatever you do, I'll always love you and care for you." You'd find that person would never go to Broome with your best friend. Why would they? Because that love which you're giving them is something very special and very rare in this world. An unconditional acceptance and love. And that's actually why, for those people with relationships, that's why I want you to try and bring your relationships up to that level. When my father told that to me, I never sort of wanted to do anything to harm that man at all. When somebody loves you that much and gives you so much trust, the reaction usually is, "I value that so highly, I'm never going to destroy that. That's something so precious, I'm going to hold that in the safest place in my heart." Someone gives so much trust, I'm going to live up to it, never exploit it. There's something about spirituality we call respect. It's something which you don't demand, but which happens quite naturally. When you see something very beautiful and wonderful, you respect it. It's just a natural response of the human heart to something sublime. And that type of love is sublime, and you do respect it. So if you can rouse yourself to say that to your partner, they will never exploit it, because it was always be respected and lived up to. What a beautiful relationship that will be. It's unconditioned, undemanding, uncontrolling. It's a letting go. And this is actually where we understand that this thing called letting go, which you hear every week if you come to this center, which is central to religions like Buddhism, which is the heart of spirituality, is another way of saying no control or just love. The door of my heart is open to a person. And of course, that relationship, that love, once you practice that on your partner, that's what the partners are there for, to practice what love is, to grow in that love. Not just so you can give that to somebody else, so they can give it to you back. Because you know, if ever you receive that degree of trust, that degree of absolute confidence, that encourages you to do the same to yourself. That's actually why it's so beautiful to be with somebody who we know is never going to put us down, never going to be critical to us, never going to actually demand us, never control us. Someone's actually going to love us and accept us with all our faults. As a monk, I've never been married, but I've met many people who have given me that unconditional love, not just my father, but just some of these great spiritual people which I've met. And the one which always stands out, I mentioned him in this talk overseas recently, was a monk called Ajahn Tate, who actually visited Perth before I came here, maybe some 30 years ago. And I went to see him in his monastery in northeast Thailand, which was on the banks of the Mekong River. And this little old monk in this huge building, which was built for him by the King of Thailand. And of course, his reputation as one of the great monks in Thailand was so powerful, I was scared. What I was scared of is this monk would read my mind. And I was only a young monk. My mind wasn't ready to be read yet. And I was actually quite scared of getting into the presence of this monk in case he had a look and told the other monks what I was about and what I was thinking. But as soon as you went into the presence of a monk like this, you felt totally accepted. It was as if that monk was saying to you, look, the door of my heart's totally open to you. I will never criticize you or put you down. I will accept you and love you for who you are, stupid as you are, Bumma Wangsa. Because I was stupid. You know, that's a wonderful feeling. To be with someone who you felt so absolutely safe with. Who you know you were loved. And this was a person I never met before. And my reaction to that is I didn't want to leave. I just wanted to stay there, sitting there for the rest of my life. And that was my reaction. I always remember that moment. It's a beautiful moment. I was with a great monk who gave me unconditional acceptance. Isn't that nice? Isn't that rare? But it wasn't just, you know, getting it from somebody else. Because the next level of that love, that spiritual love, is giving it to yourself. You learn it from other people. They give you love. And so you think, if they can give me that type of love, why can't I give it to myself? And that takes a huge leap. One of the reasons why it's a huge leap, because you think, my goodness, if I give myself unconditional love and acceptance, I'll get really worse. I'm already bad enough as it is. If I don't keep control of myself, I'm going to be really a pain in the backside for other people. But again, it doesn't work like that. If you give yourself that beautiful unconditional love, whatever I've done in the past, whatever I'm doing now, all the stupid, bad, nasty, naughty, wrong things which I've done, I never mind. Come in. It's a beautiful moment which you feel when you look at yourself with all of your faults and all of your mistakes, all the silly, terrible things which you've done in your life. And instead of putting that part of you outside, you say, come in. And that's why I love that simile, the way you put it, opening the door of your heart. That's what that simile means. You have a door, and it's closed, it's locked. Against who? Against part of yourself, the part you're ashamed of, the part you're embarrassed about. You know, the part which you don't like, which you hide, your shadow is sometimes called. Now what you do, you imagine, because you've received love from another person, because they've trusted you, they've accepted you for who you are, that gives you that encouragement to open that door to your own heart and say, come in. All the rotten, terrible things you've done, that part comes in as well. So your door is totally open to yourself. You don't have to be perfect to open that door. If you did, no one will ever become enlightened. If you needed to be perfect, you'll never find any love in this world. So you love because you're imperfect. And then you open the door of your heart and you come in. And you feel this great sense of peace and happiness and unity and oneness. You don't have to struggle so hard to change yourself. The person who loves you, they love you for who you are. They don't want to change you if it's a beautiful relationship, so why the heck do you want to change yourself? So love yourself for who you are. Totally, absolutely, 100%. With all the faults. And then again, this beautiful thing happens. It's not a blank check to to do whatever you want from now on. When you give that love to somebody else, they don't see it as a blank check to misbehave. When my father said that to me, I never thought I was now free to do whatever I liked. My father would always pick up the pieces and just look after the problems and fix things up for me. I became a much better person for that. So if you do that to yourself, you say, I forgive me. I love me. Whatever I've done in the past, the door of my heart's totally open to me. Then you become at peace with yourself. And this great war which you've been fighting ever since you could remember is now over. The same way you appreciate other people who really love you for who you are. Look like, you know, your mother. That's what the Buddha used to say, like a mother loves her only child. But no, actually, this afternoon, because I was at a funeral service for somebody, actually there's a better simile than the mother's love for her child. And that's the grandmother's love for her children. Because we were just talking at the funeral service. People give these eulogies, and they're great eulogies, because they say all these wonderful stories about their grandma. And that was actually, for those of you who have been coming here a long time, that was Mrs. De Silva. She passed away earlier this week, and a funeral service was done this afternoon. She's been coming to this Buddhist society since we were in North Perth. She's one of the founding members of this Buddhist society. So she passed away, and her grandchildren were giving the eulogies, saying whenever they came around, she'd always cook their favorite food. Even when they came home with their mates at 12:15 at night time, she would get up and cook them something. When they came around, she'd always give them $20. Even when they were 30 years old and working. That's what they said. That's actually beautiful. That's a grandmother's love for their children. Doesn't matter how old they are. They love you to bits no matter what you do. And forget about whether it's the right time to get some food. They're going to feed you. My old granny, I loved her to bits also. I could go round to her house any time and she'd make me some chips in the afternoon. 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. That used to drive my mother mad. She said, you shouldn't feed him. He's having dinner later on. You know, if my grandson wants chips, he gets chips. I love my grandma. And she loved me. And isn't that something beautiful there? It's unconditional love. Not about, you know, it's bad for your health or you shouldn't eat because you're going to have... Oh, come on. Real love is unconditional. This is saying, well, that's what you do to yourself sometimes. Little me, the door of my heart's totally open. So just like a grandmother loves her children, that's how you love yourself. Spoil yourself rotten. There's something that's just beautiful there. It's not uncritical, the way you regard yourself. And I know whenever I felt that, there's something very beautiful and spiritual. And I've noticed that. Try to understand what its heart is and to translate that into your relationships with other people and your relationships especially with yourself and your relationships with life as well. It's not just saying to yourself, the door of my heart's open to me. It's saying, life. Life, the door of my heart's totally open to you. No matter what you are, no matter what you do. The disappointments and tragedies of your life. The divorces and the separations. The wonderful moments of happiness and bliss and everything in between. The sicknesses, the times when you just knocked out with a flu or you got cancer, whatever else it is. To be able to say to all of that, the door of my heart is open to life. What a powerful thing that is. I know people say they love life. They don't love life. They just love the nice part. And the other part they try and get rid of or try and change. Imagine you say to yourself, the whole of life, I love you all. The difficulties, the blissful parts, the other parts, because you're stuck. This is life. You've got two choices. You know what they say, like it or lump it? That was a choice we had at school dinners when I was young. Like it or lump it. And there you go. You've got the choice. What are you going to do? You're going to love life or you're going to hate life and get depressed, angry, and bitter. And the thing is, when you love life, it's not as if that life gets worse because you don't fight it. When you love life, life gets much better. The cancers, they go. Why do they go? Because everybody knows that the cancers, these are things which come from depression, negativity. And we give so much negativity to ourselves and to life, we create the problems. Imagine if you had a beautiful sense of loving life. I don't think you'd get many cancers. You wouldn't get many diseases either. Certainly you wouldn't sort of get, you wouldn't need actually to go to a beautician. Or your beautician, oh, the only reason why your face wears out is because you get angry so often. If you smile much more, more relaxed and peaceful, you know, you wouldn't need Botox. They would go out of business. So when you love life, then life loves you. Which means you don't get so many problems in this life. So it becomes like a win-win situation. So when you start to learn how to love life, it means in Buddhism, it becomes the end of craving. The end of fighting this world. You're making peace with life instead of always trying to change the damn thing. Now, many of you sometimes think, oh, Ajahn Brahmi just talks about life. Yeah, it's very interesting, but what's this got to do with Buddhism? It's got everything to do with Buddhism. Four noble truths. Suffering comes from craving, from wanting. Now I just told you the end of craving. Make peace with this life. Make peace with yourself. And you can try that. Try that out when you just sit down meditating. I actually mentioned that on purpose during the meditation. Open the door of your heart to this moment. To the love, your sleepiness. What's wrong with falling asleep when you meditate? There was one occasion here. There was, I remember just over in the corner over there, there was one woman who came here during the meditation. She stretched her legs, leant back, she laid on the floor, feet pointing towards the Buddha, fell asleep and started snoring. And somebody woke her up. And I told that person off who woke her up. Never do that again. That woman, she said afterwards, she was a victim of domestic abuse. She was getting hell from her partner. And she came here, she hadn't slept for days. She came in here and she felt safe. That's all, just safe. Here was a place of kind people. And because she felt safe, she just fell asleep. The first time in days. Because we gave her that opportunity. And that's why I say, please don't wake them up. They're having a sleep. Aren't we supposed to be kind? Compassionate? I know it's against the Thai custom to point your feet at the Buddha. But people have, you know, they've pointed their feet at the Buddha many times. I've never seen the Buddha complain. Compassion and kindness, please. And so, you know, we try and have a Buddhist community, a Buddhist society which works on compassion and kindness. Yeah, rules are important. Don't point your feet at the Buddha just, you know, because you're trying to sort of make a point and being negative. But look, be kind, be compassionate. Open the door of your heart to everybody. Because that's the name of the game. And if you can do that while you are meditating, open the door of your heart to whatever's happening right now. You stop fighting, you stop trying to control your poor mind. I've often said to people when you try to meditate, why do people have so much difficulty just making their mind peaceful? Because you keep fighting. You're not kind at all. You're fighters, you're warriors, you make war with yourself. That's not the way to meditate. That's not the way to live a life. That's not the way to be a Buddhist. So try next time you sit down in this place or sit down at home. Say to your mind, the door of my heart is totally open to you no matter what you do. You can just run about. You can be sleepy. Whatever happens, I will always love you. I'm going to finish this talk with a story. I told this story at the last retreat because I remembered it was a story I hadn't told for years. It's a very beautiful story of Nandi Visala the ox. This comes from one of the Buddha's Jataka tales. There's lots of stories which the Buddha told, you know, centuries ago. Some of them are quite boring, but some of them are just have a beautiful meaning behind them. And this was one of my favorite stories in that collection, Nandi Visala the ox. There was a very, very poor farmer. This was set in India, so it's all about farmers. There was a very, very poor farmer. He had an ox called Nandi Visala. And he worked so hard trying to make ends meet. But being a farmer, you know, sometimes the rain never came. Sometimes the seed wasn't good enough. And more often than not, when he did have a good harvest, the local merchant in the village just ripped him off. You know, that's what the merchants were in those days, looking after their own profits and just exploiting the people who actually supplied the goods, the poor farmers. So just after another sort of very difficult year, the farmer was quite depressed. It's just so hard, just working his back off, trying to make ends meet for his family. So he was sitting under a tree, becoming depressed, and he felt a wet nose on his face, and it was his ox. And his ox said, "Master, I can help you." "What? An ox can speak?" In those days, oxes could speak, just like in Walt Disney. So the ox, "Yeah, I can speak. Now look, I've been serving you for such a long time, pulling the plough for you, and I'm getting tired too. And I don't want to spend the rest of my life, you know, pulling the plough to make ends meet. I want to sort of retire too, and I've got a plan. And the plan is this, you know, I'm a very, very strong ox. And what I want you to do is that merchant who's been ripping you off for years, I want you to go to that merchant and bet him $10,000. $10,000 that your ox, that's me, Nandi Visala, can pull 100 ox carts all tied together and all full of stones, rocks. And the farmer said, "Look, you can't do that." He said, "Yes, I can. And I'm very, very strong. I know what I can do. Now you go and bet $10,000. And the farmer said, "But I haven't got $10,000. You don't need $10,000. You're going to win it." So the farmer, he went to that merchant and said, "I bet you $10,000 that my ox can pull 100 carts tied together all full of rocks." And the merchant said, "Oh, don't be stupid. No ox can do that." "My ox can. $10,000. And the merchant said, "Just these farms are so stupid. It's just easy money. I know he hasn't got $10,000, but I can at least take his land. And that's worth quite a bit." So he said, "Okay, deal." And because they needed 100 carts, they had to borrow carts from everybody in the village. So everybody was out watching to see whether this ox could be so strong as to pull 100 carts full of stones. And once they tied all those carts together and they loaded them full of stones and rocks, they tied the big ox to the front cart, and the farmer went up there and said, "Right, pull those carts." And the ox didn't move. "Come on, you stupid ox, pull those carts." And the ox was stationary. He got up a stick and he hit that ox. "Come on, pull those carts. I'm going to lose everything." And the ox couldn't do it. Everybody started to laugh. The farmer started to cry. No one could pull such a heavy weight. So the farmer was devastated, totally destroyed, lost everything. He sat under the tree and started to weep. Few minutes later, he felt the wet nose in his face. "Why are you crying?" said Nandi Visala the ox. "Because of you. You said you could pull 100 carts and you can't." "Oh yes, I can." "No, you can't." "I can." "Then why didn't you?" "Because, Master, you shouted at me. And then you called me stupid. And then you hit me. That's no way to treat a friend." Doesn't matter, said the ox, I've got a plan. You go back to that merchant and you bet him $20,000 that I, Nandi Wisala, can pull those carts. But this time, treat me kindly. And the farmer was smart enough to understand. So he went back to that merchant and said, I'll bet you $20,000. And the merchant said, that's a very stupid farmer. Okay, the carts are still there, $20,000, done. And they tied the ox to the first cart. And everybody was out watching this stupid farmer. And then this time he said, dear ox, kind ox, now if it's not too much trouble for you, would you mind just trying to pull those little carts a little bit? But if it's too much, don't bother. And then that ox strained every muscle. His eyes were like bulging out. He pulled and he struggled. You know what happened? Nothing. It was too heavy. No ox could pull that much. So the farmer said, oh look, don't worry about it. You know, just stop it. And then the ox tried even harder. He pulled and he struggled until the sweat was coming out. You know what happened? Nothing. And the farmer said, look, stop it, you're going to kill yourself. It doesn't matter if we're destitute and poor. We've got each other and we love each other. So, ox, leave it alone. Don't try to. I don't want to hurt you. And because the farmer loved that ox so much, that ox pulled every muscle, not just in his body, but also in his heart. And he pulled like no other ox has ever pulled, because of the love his master showed him. You know what happened? Creak went the first axle. And once the first axle moves, once it gets started, once the friction lessens, then all the other carts started to move. Until, in a very short time, the last cart stood where the first cart had once stood. The man won his bet. He had $10,000, which was enough for him and the ox to retire and live happily ever after. And I thought that was a beautiful story when I first read it, because that's actually the power of such love, and it's very beautiful. So look, if you want your husband to take you shopping tomorrow, don't shout at him. Don't call him stupid. Don't pick up a stick. Say, dear husband, if it's not too much trouble for you, I know I've asked you very many things in this life, but would you mind if it's... I really don't want us to give you too much trouble. Would you mind taking me to the shopping tomorrow? Now that's Buddhism. That's love. That's kindness. And it's powerful, it does actually work. But don't do it that way, you do it in your own way, if you know what I mean. And there's something very beautiful about that. So you tell yourself when you meditate next, dear mind, kind mind, if you wouldn't mind too much, would you just look at the breath a little bit and be a bit peaceful? But it doesn't matter if you don't want to do that, if you're too tired, if you want to sort of think about all sorts of stupid things like you normally do, that's fine. You try that. And your mind will get very, very peaceful. Why? Because your mind and you, if you don't love each other, your mind will run away. When it sees you coming, you will think, oh my God, here she comes again. What does she want me to do this time? And run away and hide. But if you love your mind and you love your body and you love your life, with your friends with life, friends with your body, friends with your mind, of course, you'll always hang out with each other. So all that restlessness, all that wandering mind, always comes because your mind is afraid of you and wants to run away. If you can only love your mind, it will stay with you. And that's how you get very peaceful and very still and very deep. And you get to some point, this last point about love, when the mind gets really still and very peaceful, that's when you get the beautiful loves. You heard like people who sometimes have these out-of-body experiences, and they go through this beautiful light, and they feel incredible love and peace and stillness. These are the ecstatic loves. Those are called the jhanas. It's usually they call it ecstasy or bliss, but many people who experience those states, they describe that bliss, that ecstasy, that oneness as love. Pure love. This is one of the highest forms of that love. And you experience that as you develop the very deep meditations. Why do they call that love? Because it's one with everything. Not separated, not controlling, totally at peace with things, selfless. That same thing which you can feel, maybe not in its purest form, but as a seed, a spark, you know, when you have, say, your marriage. Now that reaches its perfection in those deep meditations called the jhanas. Totally at peace with the whole world. At one, singleness of mind, of thought. No separation between you and anybody. Merged. Not them, not me. Totally us. That's why people describe it as the purest of loves. Oneness. With no separation between you and life. So that's why I encourage people to take this practice of love, not just to a mundane level, but take it deeper and higher to places where you think are impossible to reach. You get there. And that's called the spiritual love, the ecstatic love. And that's there for you to actually to experience in this very life. And then you understand what love is. So it's a progressive practice, a progressive selflessness, a progressive letting go, a progressive freedom and non-controlling, a progressive not criticizing, a progressive not fault-finding. You do that further and further, deeper and deeper, not only does it make your life more healthy and more happy, and all the relationships which you will have anyway become far more stable, fulfilling. And especially the relationship you have with yourself becomes this beautiful relationship where you do open the door of your heart to yourself. You do grow. You do go more peaceful. The meditation becomes easier. I don't know why people struggle with meditation. Meditation is the easiest thing in the world to do. Just do nothing. Just love this moment. And it just turns out to be very peaceful and very deep. And see if you can go to those ecstasy states. Which, as far as love goes, is the highest form of love. That's why people explain it that way. So that's the Buddhist idea of love. Progressive and practical and available for everyone in this room today. Thank you. Okay, any comments about the different types of love in Buddhism? Answering a question which somebody said to me to talk about. Yes, thank you. Gentleman over there.
In your view, what is the higher spiritual purpose?
The higher purpose, love or happiness, join the two together. So love happiness and have a happy love. And it's really important to have like that warmth and that happiness. We're just talking about any one of you who comes to visit our monasteries. If you don't feel that sort of that happiness, that lightheartedness and that friendliness there, what type of a spiritual community is it? And so actually you can usually tell a monastery, a community, just you know, by the sort of the sense of lightheartedness, the lightness, the happiness. And just the sense of sort of easygoing love which you feel. So if you go into a place and it's very austere and people are shouting at you, sit up, don't ask stupid questions, do it this way, put your shoes in the right way, don't point your feet at the Buddha, blah, blah, blah. That type of controlling and fear, there's something terribly missing. That's why there's sometimes that's why some religions really don't cut it. Now, do you ever see sort of the Pope laugh? Do you ever, you know, see sort of, you know, the priests sort of crack jokes? Some of them do, and they're the ones who have, you know, good lots of people coming to see them. So what's the point of spirituality if it doesn't make you happy and doesn't espouse happiness? If you have a loving relationship, aren't you happy? So the two go together. Next question. No, going, gone.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhemi suvākkhato bhagavata dhammo dhammaṃ namassāmi Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghaṃ namāmi.